The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Greg Cockcroft from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is The Atlantic. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from The Atlantic magazine. And we will start today with this article, if I can get my hands on to it. The world has laws about land and sea, but not about ice. This was written by Brett Simpson. When the Chinese cargo freighter Istanbul Bridge set sail for Europe late September, it took an unusual route. Instead of heading south for the 40-day voyage through the Suez Canal, it tacked north. The freighter arrived in the United Kingdom at the port of Felixstowe just 20 days later, successfully launching the first-ever Arctic commercial container route from Asia to Europe. For most of human history, the surface of the world's northernmost ocean has been largely frozen. Now scientists predict that most of the Arctic Ocean's 6.1 million square miles may be seasonally ice-free as soon as 2050. Economically, a less icy Arctic spells opportunity, new shipping routes, and untapped fossil fuel reserves. Climatologically, it's a calamity. Legally, it's a problem that has to be solved. Much of the ocean's center, the northernmost stretch surrounding the pole, will be subject to the lawlessness of the high seas, which will become a problem as more ships try to navigate a mushy mix of water and sea ice. And although the Arctic is the world's fastest warming region, it contains its most rapidly acidifying ocean. It has few environmental protections. Scientists don't have a clear idea of which species might need defending, or of the climate effects of unbridled shipping. Ships puff black carbon, which reduces ice reflectivity and, in the short term, causes up to 1,500 times more warming than carbon dioxide. In October, the United Nations Special Envoy for the Ocean, Peter Thompson, called for countries to agree to a precautionary pause on new economic activities in the central Arctic Ocean to buy time to study the climate and environmental risks of increased activity. Others are asking for an agreement akin to the 2020 Artemis Accords, which committed 59 nations to a peaceful and sustainable exploration of space. But some polar law scholars argue that curbing climate catastrophe may require a more radical reimagining to make sea ice a legal person. For centuries of seafaring, ice was an obstacle blocking people out, not an environment anyone thought to protect. Even in the Arctic, we have laws about the land, we have laws of the law of the sea, but we don't have laws about ice. Apostolos Tsouvalos, a postdoctoral researcher with the Arctic University of Norway, told me, because dealing with ice hasn't been a major concern, even for the five nations that border the Arctic, because ice is always transforming, its place in the law is confused at best. In many cases, solid ice extending from a coastline has been treated as legal land, and ice carried by a current has been considered water. During the Cold War, both Russia and the United States maintained scientific drift stations on detached ice floes. In 1970, when a shooting occurred on one American station, several nations debated where exactly the crime took place. Was the ice Canadian? Because it likely calved from a glacier on Canada's coast. Was it an American island? After some back and forth, the vessel-sized chunk of ice legally transformed, by no small imaginative leap, into an American ship. The so-called Arctic exception of the United Nations Convention on the Law of the Sea does extend states' rights to impose laws far from the coastline, in areas that are ice-covered for most of the year. The point was for Arctic states to help prevent accidents and pollution, but states have since used the exception to extend their geographical sovereignty. But the term ice-covered complicates these claims. How much ice means covered? Are we talking unfrozen, uncrossably frozen, or just a few drifting bits? That's the problem with regulating icy regions. Even if these cryo-categories were more formalized, none would apply for very long. A large majority of Arctic ice is sea ice, which forms on ocean surfaces when salt water freezes. It's distinct from icebergs, which calve from landbound glaciers. Human activity may have accelerated its melt, but sea ice was already one of the planet's most dynamic systems, its surface area fluctuating by millions of miles season to season. It's always either melting or freezing, and as it melts, its fragments can travel hundreds of miles along waves and currents. In an article published this month in the journal The Yearbook of Polar Law, Suvalis and his co-authors Mana Tugend and Romain Chouffard argue that piecemeal updates to current laws will never keep up with this fast-changing and threatened environment. Future governance of sea ice will require a transformation of some sort, and they argue that the clearest path forward is to bring the rights of nature movement to the high north. Since Ecuador's landmark 2008 constitutional protection of nature, Bolivia, India, New Zealand, and other countries across the world have made natural entities legal persons, or otherwise given them inviolable rights. The UCLA law professor James Salzman, who has taught a class on nature's rights, told me that this idea does not represent a single legal framework, but that it does answer what he calls the Lorax problem of environmental law, referring to the Dr. Seuss character who claims to speak for the trees. Granting a voiceless entity legal personhood provides it with a representative to argue on its behalf. With this designation, Suvalis and his co-authors note, sea ice would get the highest legal status possible. In many cases, environmental protections can be bent to accommodate other conflicting benefits to human society, but personhood grants an inherent right to exist that can't be superseded. The new paper is mostly an ethical exploration, and the authors acknowledge still just a stepping stone to more concrete regulations. But granting ice rights would create firmer standing to, for example, keep ships out of areas that humanity might otherwise want to use. The authors also note that rethinking sea ice's status could include indigenous people who have been routinely excluded from decisions around Arctic sovereignty, and whose millennia of living on and with ice could guide its future governance. But Sarah Olsvig, the chair of the Inuit Circumpolar Council, told me recently that the legal interest in Arctic rights of nature is a worrying development. To Olsvig, the phrase rights of nature itself implies some separate concept of nature that doesn't exist for the Inuit. And in the past, the environmentalist movement has elevated its idea of nature above the interests of indigenous people. Decades-long bans against whale and seal hunting, for instance, devastated the cultural continuity and health of Inuit in the far north. To answer such concerns, any legal right granted needs to be very clear about the duties that follow, Salzman said. If sea ice has a right to not be harmed, what constitutes harm? Would that mean blocking all human interference with the ice, or merely banning fuels that emit black carbon? After all, the major threat to sea ice, global emissions, is not something that can be locally managed, Salzman pointed out, and so far natural resources have obtained legal personhood only in a national context. Rights for sea ice would require international agreement, which could be not only harder to achieve, but harder to enforce. Sarah Ross, an associate law professor at Dalhousie University in Canada, told me that, in her view, legal personhood granted via international treaty would be too dependent on goodwill agreements to be effective. But in some ways, legal personhood for non-humans is an old idea, Ross said. Most countries grant it to corporations, and in the United States and Commonwealth countries, it's typical for ships, too. She especially likes the ship comparison because, as maritime law has already discovered, floating pieces of ice aren't so dissimilar. She imagines a more circumscribed role for sea ice personhood, connected to, say, setting standards that ban ice breaking or heavy fuel emissions in icy areas. If these mandates are violated, local Inuit communities would have the power to sue on behalf of the ice, whether or not they could prove how much one particular ship degraded one particular stretch of ice. Without some legal protections put in place, the sea ice will soon disappear that much faster. In October, the U.S. bought new ice-breaking ships from Finland and undermined an international maritime organization agreement that would have had ship owners pay a fee for the greenhouse gases their vessels emit. The next week, just after the conclusion of the Istanbul Bridge's voyage, Russia and China made a formal agreement to co-develop the Northern Sea route that the ship had followed. If summer sea ice disappears entirely, scientists predict accelerated catastrophe, leaps in temperature, more frequent and stronger storms, global sea level rise, which will threaten the planet's general livability. The fact that we need sea ice to survive is not a rights of nature argument, Salzman said, but it's still a pretty good case to make. Our next article was featured in the Ideas section of the Atlantic magazine and also featured in the One Story to Read Today newsletter. Reading is a Vice, written by Adam Kirsch. If you read a book in 2025, just one book, you belong to an endangered species. Like honeybees and red wolves, the population of American readers, Lector Americanus, has been declining for decades. The most recent survey of public participation in the arts, from 2022, found that fewer than half of Americans had read a single book in the previous 12 months. Only 38% had read a novel or short story. A recent survey from the University of Florida and University College London found that the number of Americans who engage in daily reading for pleasure fell 3% each year from 2003 to 2023. This decade is only getting steeper. The decline is only getting steeper, excuse me. Over the past decade, American students' reading abilities have plummeted, and their reading habits have followed suit. In 2023, just 14% of 13-year-olds read for fun almost every day, down from 27% a decade earlier. A growing share of high school and even college students struggle to read a book cover to cover. Educators and policymakers have been agonizing about this trend line for decades, but they haven't managed to change it. Now some are trying a new tactic. If people won't read books because they enjoy it, perhaps they can be persuaded to do it to save democracy. The International Publishers Association, which represents publishers in 84 countries, has spent the past year promoting the slogan, "Democracy Depends on Reading," arguing that ambitious, critical, reflective reading remains one of the few spaces where citizens can rehearse complexity recover attention, and cultivate the inner freedoms that public freedoms require. The problem with these kinds of arguments isn't that they are wrong. It's that they don't actually persuade anyone to read more, because they misunderstand why people become readers in the first place. Telling someone to love literature because reading is good for society is like telling someone to believe in God because religion is good for society. It's a utilitarian argument for what should be a personal passion. It would be better to describe reading not as a public duty, but as a private pleasure, sometimes even a vice. This would be a more effective way to attract young people, and it also happens to be true. When literature was considered transgressive, moralists couldn't get people to stop buying and reading dangerous books. Now that books are considered virtuous and edifying, moralists can't persuade anyone to pick one up. One of my strongest early memories of reading comes from fifth grade, when I was so engrossed in a book that I read right through a spelling test without noticing it was happening. I remember this incident partly because I was afraid I would get in trouble. But I think the real reason it stays in my memory after 40 years was the feeling of uncanniness. The time that had passed in the classroom had not passed for me. In a real sense, I was in another world, the world of the book. Being a reader means cultivating a relationship with a world that, by most standards, can seem pointless and counterproductive. Reading is not profitable. It doesn't teach you any transferable skills or offer any networking opportunities. On the contrary, it is an antisocial activity in the most concrete sense. To do it, you have to be alone, or else pretend you are alone by tuning out other people. Reading teaches you to be more interested in what's going on inside your head than in the real world. Anyone who was a bookish child could probably tell a similar story to mine. Marcel Proust tells one in Swan's Way, the first volume of his epic novel, In Search of the Lost Time, when he writes about reading on summer afternoons in the country and not hearing the church bell. Sometimes it would even happen that this precocious hour would sound two strokes more than the last. There must then have been an hour which I had not heard strike. Something which had taken place had not taken place for me. The fascination of my book, a magic as potent as the deepest slumber, had stopped my enchanted ears and had obliterated the sound of that golden bell from the azure surface of the enveloping silence. In this passage, the ability to fall so deeply under the spell of a book seems like a blessing. But as the novel goes on, Proust's narrator shows that his sensitivity to books, and later to music and art, is an expression of the same qualities that make him unfit for life and relationships. He is so susceptible to the poetry of place names that when he visits the actual places, he is always disappointed. His hyper-awareness of what is going on inside his mind makes him an egotist. Other people exist for him as providers of emotional stimuli, not as real individuals with their own minds and desires. As a rule, if you're looking for evidence that reading makes you a better world citizen, the last place you'll find it is in the great work of great writers. They know too much about literature to idealize it the way educators do. In fact, some of the greatest novels are about how reading ruins lives. Starting from the book often considered the first modern novel, Don Quixote, Cervantes' comic hero is addicted to, quote, reading books of chivalry, end quote, until his fancy grew full of what he used to read about in his books: enchantments, quarrels, battles, challenges, wounds, wooings, loves, agonies, and all sorts of impossible nonsense. Convinced that he is a character in a novel, which of course he is, he embarks on a series of knightly adventures that go laughably and pathetically wrong. Centuries later, the heroine of Gustave Flaubert's novel Madame Bovary makes the same mistake, with more tragic consequences. Emma Bovary is addicted to reading. Flaubert, writes that as a teenager, she made her hands dirty with books from old lending libraries. When she gets married and finds she doesn't love her husband the way novels had led her to expect, she turns to adultery to find out what one meant exactly in life by the words felicity, passion, rapture, that had seemed to her so beautiful in books. But what is beautiful in books turns out to be ugly in life, and Emma's attempt to live like the heroine of a romance ends in ruin and suicide. After Madame Bovary was published in 1856, its frank depiction of sexual immorality got Flaubert prosecuted in Paris for obscenity. He was acquitted, and the attempt to censor the novel only made it more popular. Just as would happen in the 20th century with Ulysses and Lady Chatterley's Lover. Today, all of these books are considered classics, which means that most of us encounter them only in the classroom, as objects of dutiful study. If we want to keep reading from going extinct, then the best thing we could do is to tell young people what so many great writers readily admit. Literature doesn't make you a better citizen or a more successful person. A passion for reading can even make life more difficult. And you don't cultivate a passion for the sake of democracy. You do it for the thrill of staying up late to read under the covers by flashlight, unable to stop and hoping no one finds out. Our third article, The Slow Inevitable Death of the Bowl Game, written by Keith O'Brien. It's been a hard month for the once prestigious College Bowl. Just hours after Notre Dame learned that it would not be included in the season's college football playoff, the mega-popular, multi-billion-dollar, 12-team invitational that crowns an NCAA Division I champion, the team announced that it would not play in any bowl whatsoever this year. Nine other programs, including Florida State, Auburn, and Baylor, soon followed Notre Dame's lead, declining bowl bids. Fans, pundits, and football insiders lashed out at these schools for refusing to finish out the season with one final game. Notre Dame took the brunt of the criticism. People called the team quitters and wondered if its choice sounded a death knell for the entire bowl tradition. Here's the reality. The bowls have been dying a slow death in terms of cultural importance since 1998, when the College Bowl power brokers instituted the first national championship game open to teams from every major conference. The move to a four-team playoff in 2014 hastened the decline of the old bowl system, and last year's expansion to a 12-team playoff put it on life support. With the best teams now competing in a proper playoff, the other postseason games have effectively become consolation prizes, late-season scrimmages with no stakes whatsoever. The power brokers who created the national title game back in 1998 worried that this would cause irrelevance. In an effort to focus on a championship game, the Big East commissioner Mike Trankees said way back at the start, "We're putting all the other bowls in a negative position." At the time, the bowls truly mattered. In the 1989-90 season, teams played just 18 bowl games. For many players, a bowl game was one of their only chances to appear on national television, and exposure launched careers. The Rose Bowl, the Orange Bowl, the Sugar Bowl, and the Cotton Bowl dated back to the early 20th century and managed to transcend sports, becoming must-watch TV on New Year's Day. The Rose Bowl, perhaps most of all. Jim Delaney, a former commissioner of the Big Ten, told me recently that the teams in his conference didn't dream about winning national titles. They dreamed about going to Pasadena, California, to play in the Rose Bowl. It was welcomed as a cultural event, Delaney said. It had a great time slot on New Year's Day at 2 p.m. local, 5 p.m. Eastern. The parade and the ratings were Super Bowl-esque in the 50s and 60s. Even the lesser bowls, such as the Holiday Bowl, played for the first time in 1978 in San Diego, mattered. Ty Detmer, the quarterback at Brigham Young University from 1988 to 1991, threw for 576 yards against Penn State in the 1989 Holiday Bowl, which was broadcast on ESPN. The following season, Detmer won the Heisman Trophy, the most prestigious award in college football. In a lot of ways, Detmer told me, he could trace his Heisman win to his performance in that game against Penn State. That put us on the map, he said. It was the culmination of our season, even though it wasn't a national championship. Fans demanded a new system, and one man had a solution. Roy Kramer, the commissioner of the Southeastern Conference, believed that he could preserve the sanctity of the bowls while giving people a national champion they wanted. Kramer pulled together a coalition of fellow commissioners, including Delaney at the Big Ten. Together, they laid the groundwork for the Bowl Championship Series, a format that would include every major conference and create the first-ever national title game that would name an indisputable college football champion. Huddling in a small library at the Southeastern Conference headquarters with a young public relations man named Charles Bloom, Kramer set out to invent a mathematical formula that used data points, including a team's overall record and the strength of its schedule, to determine which two teams should get the call to play in the title game. Kramer was driven to get the formula right, demanding relentless research. When they thought they had one that worked, Kramer and Bloom checked it against the results of previous seasons to make sure that it successfully chose the best two teams. And when the system was unveiled in 1998, Kramer had created a new and more certain world. Finally, the college football season would end with a clear champion. Almost immediately, the criticism came. Today, people are arguing about the 12th and 13th teams, Bloom said. Well, back then, you were arguing about the second and third teams. Kramer said he could list 100 reasons an expanded playoff would be bad for the sport, one being it would make the bowls irrelevant. But with more spots in the playoff field, more teams could now make a credible case that they should have been included. In general, most people agree that the 12-team playoff launched last year has been good for college football. Before the second season with the new playoff format is even over, Kramer's predictions are coming true. The bowls do mean less because the playoff is now everything. This postseason involves 11 playoff games with high stakes and big crowds, as well as 35 other bowl games, played for the most part by mediocre teams with mediocre records, with very little fanfare at all. These games aren't the Rose Bowl of yesteryear. They aren't even the Holiday Bowl circa 1989. You can bet that more college programs will skip them in the future. They don't want bowls. They want the playoffs, which the college football power brokers are already considering expanding again. That third article was edited because we've run out of time for today's episode of The Atlantic. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Greg Cockcroft, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. The Atlantic is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org.